Hey, this is Evan Phillips from Anchorage, Alaska. You're listening to The Fern Line. Alaska, the highest concentration of big, remote mountains in North America. For generations, a unique group of climbers have tested themselves in these vast alpine arenas. The Chugach, St. Elias, the Hays, Neocola, the Kachatnas, the Revelations. Their stories are etched on high alpine walls. Their visions follow lines of cold gray ice. What inspires them? What makes them come back? Who survives? Who suffers? These are the stories we'll tell on Season 1 of The Fern Line. Hey friends, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fern Line, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. On Season 1, I'll chat with alpinists and other outdoor enthusiasts who are pushing the limits of what's possible in Alaska's mountains. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with extraordinary people, folks who choose to live full-value lifestyles in one of the most beautiful and wild regions on the planet. So grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch or camp chair and settle in for the next hour on this episode of The Fern Line.
I think we all probably have a lot of defined limitations that are just defined on what's normal or what's understood to be normal for whatever, outdoor sports, life, relationships, whatever. And in the process of going through these classics, having a little bit of a safety net, and then applying it to bigger mountains, longer trips, like what's come out of that is sort of an awe at how capable I am just by being human.
On today's episode, we'll get to know Alaskan mountain adventurer Luke Mail. Growing up on the banks of the Kuskokwim River in the remote village of McGrath, Luke was inspired at a young age by the clarity of simple living and the vast Alaskan wilderness surrounding him. When he moved to Anchorage for high school, he had his first forays with rock climbing and other outdoor sports. But at that time, academics were the driving force in his life. After graduating from high school, Luke studied geology and spent semesters doing fieldwork in Italy and Greenland. This was followed by stints at UC Santa Barbara and MIT, where he would go on to earn dual master's degrees. But as much as Luke enjoyed school, he'd always struggled to find balance between the rigid structure of academia and the more dynamic lifestyle he'd known as a kid. Ultimately, Luke returned to Alaska in 2003, deeply depressed and unsure of which direction to take. It was during this time, a time Luke refers to as his dark year, that he literally stumbled into the mountains, only to come out on the other side with a restored sense of purpose and a new way of living.
So I had a really hard breakup after Santa Barbara. I my girlfriend from college, and then we stayed together while we were in California. She was in Oakland. She was with me in Santa Barbara for a year and then went to grad school in Oakland. And so I was commuting between Santa Barbara and Oakland, which was horrible. But then just a devastating breakup. And my first breakup, you know, we'd been together 3 or 4 years. So it was major. And I went into a pretty serious depression from that and came home. That was a big part of the breakup, was that I knew I needed to be in Alaska. And so I basically think of that as my dark year, struggling with depression. And I somehow I managed to save money in grad school, which is like impossible. Yeah. I'm super frugal. That's also probably village style.
Yeah.
So I got home in the middle of the winter. I think it was December or January, home being moved to Anchorage, and had enough money that I didn't have to work right away. And so I had a policy. I would do anything that I would do as a volunteer. And if I got paid for it, great. But I could float for a little while. I got a shitty apartment that had like a broken thermostat. So it was always like 80 degrees. And I had no furniture and nothing, bed. And I'm just like in there on my own, hitting my head against the wall. And the big escape for me was learning how to ski. And I hadn't skied. I skied once when I was like 10 with an uncle and twisted my knee or something. Had to wear a brace for a while. And then I was on a snowboard in high school because that was cooler. And I started on a snowboard here, and then I realized it sucked to carry a snowboard for backcountry. I hadn't done any backcountry before, though. So I basically just dove in headfirst, I guess literally, to learning how to ski. And had some partners, high school friends that were already doing backcountry skiing, and they were completely unsympathetic to me not knowing how to ski. They wouldn't alter their plans because of that, and so I was just in for the, you know, steep lines and whatever, just falling my way down them. So it was very physical, and it was a very steep learning curve, and it was the path out of that depression for me. Like, it was obvious at the time, and I embraced it. You know, if things were getting too dark, I just put on skis, go to Kincaid. You know? But every single weekend, these two guys, John and Jeremiah, like the three of us, those guys were single. So we were super available. We weren't checking weather. We were just like, where are we meeting? Cause we know we're meeting the next morning. Super healthy. So that was 2004. That was in between the Santa Barbara program and the MIT program. And that was definitely the point where it became a lifestyle choice. And I think that year ended with John wanting to do... He had done a couple of the Wilderness Classics, and there was a shorter adventure race, what was it called? The Hammer. And so he convinced Jer and I to do it, and we did it, and there was a section that you ran, there was a section that you biked, there was a section that you skied, and a section you could snowshoe. And we got lost immediately, right? And then we just rocked it. And we'd been spending all this time together all winter, had a really nice dynamic, we're in great shape. And we ended up getting third or something, and it was so much fun. So that kind of effectively was the end of that dark year and of that window back in Alaska before I went to Massachusetts for another grad program.
Walking across the old town where I found myself, I saw you standing right there, thinking out loud what was on your mind. I could only look inside of my own thick skin. I was drifting. Ooh, needing someone.
Luke would go on to complete his master's degree at MIT, but it was the profound Alaskan landscape that would shape the next decade of his life. In 2008, building off his increased skills in the outdoors, Luke teamed with a small group of friends and entered the Wilderness Classic, an infamous point-to-point race that crosses hundreds of miles of remote mountains, glaciers, and rivers. Although the race was physically and mentally taxing in ways Luke never could have imagined, it was the rawness of the land, the simplicity of survival, and the friendships forged that would leave the most lasting imprint. Don't forget me.
Basically, the classics are you have a starting point and you have a finish point, and the rest is up to you. You have to self-rescue, but it's your own route, your own gear. There are some required gear, like sat phone, and depending on the route, you might be required to carry an ice axe or something. But basically, they're in different locations, different mountain ranges, and they're the locations, the start and end, are always selected so that there are non-technical and then maybe semi-technical or more technical routes, so people can come in with different experience levels or different comforts and have a route that's appropriate for them. And there's the summer one has a little bit of a competitive edge to it. People want to win. I mean, people want to finish first in everything, I guess, in life, but it's very laid back, and the priority is very obviously just on finishing. And if anybody was having any issue and needed help, every one of the participants would stop and help. Like, it is not a race in the sort of eco challenge sense of the race or adventure racing, like the marketed stuff. There's no marketing. It's grassroots. It's like an email chain is the organization. So very Alaskan in nature. So for that first one, so John had done some summer classics, a couple of them, and he came back just destroyed. You know, he's limping around and scars all over him, and blisters. But we had an incredible dynamic. He's an amazing partner, and so I wanted to do whatever he wanted to do, and he wanted to do a winter one. He hadn't done a winter. We tried to get Jer, and Jer wasn't interested in it. So my first classic was a winter classic with John, and we ended up teaming up with Tyler Johnson. So we teamed up and did this winter classic that was from Nabesna to McCarthy, and super intimidated going into it, because it's one thing to go light in the summer, but in the winter, none of us having done, Tyler had done a bunch of the summers, but no winters too. So we're all three going in without a lot of experience, and we brought Taco Bell burritos as one of our main food groups. And that was largely because of Tyler's input. He had been going on a kick for years where they were fueling everything on like Arby's and McDonald's. And
yeah.
So we were getting bean burritos and they freeze solid.
Yeah.
So you're gnawing on a frozen black bean burrito. But you know, they're wrapped and they're cheap, and you get the little 10 pack for $10, and off you go. So we had burritos, and basically the strategy is just to go as long as you can, to push as hard as you can. And in the winter, that still means you end up sleeping. We would probably set up camp at 12 or 1 in the morning, and then wait until somebody gets cold, to maybe 4 or 5 in the morning, somebody's shivering a little too much and says, we gotta get moving. So we get moving. In the summer, it's not uncommon to go through the night because you've got the light and you can. But in the winter, it's a little bit, that part of it's a little easier. Like, you're kind of forced to sleep and recover. Yeah. Navigation is too hard in the dark.
On that first trip specifically, were you bivvying out, or did you have a tent, or?
We had a two-man tent for the three of us.
Did you have sleeping bags?
We had sleeping bags, yeah. I think John and I had plus 20 bags, and Tyler had like plus 40 bag. And so he was in the middle, just getting spooned. And because it was a two-man tent, we were in there tight, and that helped a lot. But we're
wearing everything you have.
Absolutely everything you have, and the hot water cozy. Yeah. But we're we're drinking overflow and any open water we can find, because we don't want to take the time or fuel. I'm not carrying enough fuel to melt all the snow we would need. So you're cutting every corner. Our packs were probably 25 pounds, 30 pounds to cover 180 miles. We were going about 40 miles a day. And Northern Lights every night, and learning how to Nordic ski. I'd never Nordic skied before. So basically, and then Tyler didn't have the form either, but John had like actual Nordic ski form. So we would just fall behind him and try to mimic him. Like, he's moving his left leg and his right arm at the same time. So I'll try that, you know, like learning on the spot, and insane dehydration and tendonitis. We're just popping, you know, 10, 20 Aleves a day, and just to kill the pain and get through that. I remember at the end, I convinced them to chew up our Aleves, because I thought I would get in the bloodstream faster, which is probably true. I don't know if you ever chewed that stuff, but it's like toxic, you know, it's like an acid burn in your mouth, and then you were totally dehydrated, so you have cotton mouth, and then this, that taste, and then they were so pissed at me for that. And it was amazing, like, to kind of see what we could do, and how hard that was, and end up having traveled 180 miles in 4 days, or 4.5 days. It was incredibly empowering, and it was a kind of earth-shattering trip, I think, definitely for John and I, and probably for Tyler too. Kind of opened the horizons to me of this, like, this whole other side of being human that I'd never really acknowledged or knew about, like, this, that we survive, and if you're cold, you move, and there's all these tricks and all these sort of just fundamental, like, primal skills that I had never needed on a backpacking trip or on anything else outside. So I guess what I'm trying to convey is that it was a huge eye opener as to what I could do as a human, in the real world, in the mountain world. And it was addictive. And some guys have talked about it being like a drug addictive. It's like, you need that rush. And I don't at this point need that rush, but I think I really was more into it as a learning experience. But as somebody that loves landscapes and Alaska, like, to be able to see that much of Alaska that quickly, it was just this, like, beautiful alignment of all these interests of mine.
Over the next few years, Luke continued racing in the classics, improving his style, and working toward transferring that knowledge to his personal trips. This orbit culminated in a 2012 climb and traverse of Mount Logan with Joshua Foreman, Graham Kraft, Josh Mumm, and John Sykes. The team traveled 370 miles in 30 days, surviving avalanches and altitude sickness, before summiting the mountain and then pack rafting their way to McCarthy, Alaska.
So we started, we're carrying 130 pounds, and so looking at options from Yakutat, we basically don't want to double haul as much as possible. We want to get on the ice as soon as we can and use our pack rafts as sleds. That was our approach. And so the easiest way to do that was not the shortest way, but it was to go on the fjord system and paddle. So we paddled 3 days to get to a tributary glacier, and we ended up only having to double haul 2 miles, 3 miles, something ridiculous, and got on the ice, and we were able to tow from there on. So that's where I'm saying again, this all of this, all of these route planning tricks that I learned, that we'd learned through those classics, like this is where they paid off.
Once you got on the glacier, what was the travel like to the base of Logan?
Initially, the travel was horrible because it was just dumping rain and we're in whiteout and trying to pull uphill, you know, just to try to get out of the rain. And we were navigating by GPS, and basically after maybe 2 days of that, we realized it wasn't worth it. We were spending too much energy to not get enough ground. So we decided just to wait and make the call. If it keeps storming, we'll turn around.
So you hunkered down kind of in that weather, and then what happened after that?
So it rained, rained during the day each day, and snowed at night each night. So just the snow total was something like, I can't remember, 4 feet in 3 days or 3 feet in 2 days. And that's still, that's not counting like the 12 hours of rain that we're getting each day. So we're just getting hammered. And then it pops. We see the sun, we start moving. So it took us maybe a week to get there. Once we went after that storm, maybe 5 days. But we're watching it get bigger, and the weather's good. Our stuff's drying out. Like we're, morale is good. And we get to the base, and then accessing the ridge is this little 200 meter apron. And we get to the top and get an avalanche. And I was buried, and Foreman was tumbled. He was kind of above the debris. And super fortunate, I was able to pop an air pocket at the end, get my arm to the surface, get my hand to the surface, and breathe along my arm. But it was, you know, of course, we're freaked out.
Close call.
Super close call. And with that ridge, if it had happened anywhere else, no question. I mean, it was cliffs everywhere else. It was just this access point. But then took a day to recover there and talk about what we're going to do. And I was totally shaken up. And Foreman had maybe he had a green stick fracture in his lower leg. So he knew something was wrong, but it wasn't so wrong that he couldn't move.
So this avalanche happened at the base of the East Ridge. And so you changed your route after that?
We talked about our options, about turning around, flying out, going around. Foreman is not interested in anything besides the East Ridge because he was our technical climber. And he hadn't done any of these longer trips. He hadn't done the classics, but he was really psyched for a technical route. So we're hemming and hawing, talking all of these options through, and we basically decide to wrap around to the King's Trench, which is a standard non-technical route up, and Foreman can fly out. Basically, we have a couple days to get there. I think it was 80 miles to get to the King's Trench from where we were. So he flew out. That was pretty easy to arrange because there's people coming in to climb on the King's Trench. And the rest of us crammed into our three-man tent and made a push for the summit. And we've got just barely enough. We basically got like the window to go directly, you know, from the landing zone where people do these trips up to 19,000 and back, and we've got that much food. And so it's interesting, we're in great shape because we've just been like out in the mountains for that long carrying weight, but we're running out of fuel, you know, to keep our engines going. So everybody we see that's leaving the mountain, we make small talk until somebody's comfortable enough to say, "Hey, so we got any food?" So we started calling ourselves Team Vulture.
Yeah.
And that stuck. That's every trip since, that's been part of our mode. And it's like, we got some chocolate from a Swiss team, and we got some mountain houses from so and so. And so we get to there's a nice camp at 16, and we tell somebody that's what we're doing. We're going to try to make one push to the top. And he's like, you can't do it. You know, you need to acclimate up higher. And we're like, yeah, you know, we don't have time for that.
Yeah.
We just came from Yakutat, you know, like if it's possible, we'll be able to do it. And then I feel like we waited for a weather for half day or maybe a full day. And then Josh Mum in the middle of the night popped his head out the window and said, "Well, my watch stopped working a couple hours ago, but probably time to get up and go." And we packed up and moved, and really good light until we reached this plateau. Logan is like a huge massive massif. Like you have maybe 2 miles at basically 19,000 feet to get to the summit proper. And a lot of people don't bother because of that. And we get to that plateau maybe around noon after this, you know, 3 a.m., 4 a.m. start. And then we get, the weather comes in and we're losing visibility, and we keep going. We're following GPS track that we've got from Joe Stock, who'd been up there a couple of years before. And so we're just using that to get to the summit. And John Sykes starts to get altitude sickness, and we're really close. And it's like, do we push for it? We can't see anything, so what's the point? But I'm super motivated. But we know we're pushing it. We meet up. We're like, there's a bump. We can kind of see what we think is probably the summit in this whiteout. And I think it's probably half an hour for us to get up there and back. I think it's worth it. And discuss, and we decide to push and do it. And we get up there, and we see an axe on the summit. We can't see anything else. We're like
an ice axe?
Yeah, an ice axe. And we're like, that's a nice axe. And we'd lost an axe. I'd lost my axe in the avalanche, so we were an axe short. So we grab the axe and drop down and book it, you know, on this like 2 miles at altitude, just slogging, going by GPS. And eventually, you know, around midnight or something, we kind of know we're on the home stretch. Like, we're off the plateau and we just have to work back down to our camp. And there's like a weird haze in the air that's more than the whiteout. And I'm checking in with the guys, like, what are you guys seeing, this weird haze? What's going on? And nobody else is seeing it. And it was getting snowblind because I wasn't able to see my screen well enough with my goggles on. So I'd had my goggles off all day because I was running the GPS. So we get done. It was like a 20-hour push or something, and maybe 24 hours. Get back to the tent and hole up for a couple days. And I'm like in agonizing pain because of the snow blindness, and we're in the storm, we can't move anyway. And as it was, they cut a book cover out and put a couple holes in it and put that as a inside my goggles.
Yeah.
And then
like just like little slits,
tiny, yeah, there's like punch holes in it. And and then I basically just like was skiing distance apart. I stayed close enough that I could see the tails of the guys in front of me snow plowing down to get off, to get from our high camp there. And it was really tough and hugely rewarding.
Yeah.
You know, like, nothing has been that rewarding to have done that. And then to have a beautiful exit. We had a cruiser downhill with a nice crust. We flew down and we had great weather. The first night when we were on rock after, you know, 25 days on snow or something, I just can't even think of the word. I remember looking down at Graham, who like rolled off of his pad in the middle of the night, was just sleeping in the sand and so content, you know.
Yeah.
And we're so thin, we're wearing our huge parkas, even though it's now, you know, 50 degrees, 60 degrees, whatever. And that was a beautiful part of this trip, these huge fires and smells and plants. And we still weren't done. We had a bad swim. I was wearing my ski boots, even though I was only in the water for a couple minutes. It was just, boom, hypothermic. And those guys had to help me out of my clothes. It happened to be the first place that there was driftwood, which was another of these luck margins. You know, if it had been 10 miles upriver, we would have been in trouble. Just pounded me with hot fluids and nice fire and all of those things on this margin, this safety margin. And we got so lucky.
So what was the route out then?
It's all pretty vague out there. We took No Name Glacier, because it doesn't have a name on the map, to the headwaters of the Chitna River, and then used our boats as boats again after dragging them this whole way. Floated the Chitna down to McCarthy, and we stopped at Ultima Thule Lodge, which was on the way. We're maybe just a day, 2 days out, but we've been kind of rationing our food and eating less and less. We've got like a pound each at this point. We pull into Ultima Thule, and there's like a young, I don't know, lodge hand or something, and he's like, oh, cool, how you guys doing? We're just like, can't even have conversations. We're like so socially inept at this point, and we're just like, he offers us like a shower, a sauna, and some coffee. and we're like, let's take that coffee, you know. We're not gonna bother with the sauna, and we're hurting, you know, and we know we're close and things are gonna be fine, but so we have our coffee and we're like, well, back on the river. We got a headwind on the river, you know, we're so thin. I remember that like a little cloud would go over the sun and we'd get cold instantly. Okay, so we're leaving, and then Jay Claus shows up, and Jay knew John Sykes, and he's like, whoa, you guys come in. You know, he knew we were trying this route, and he's like, you guys come in from Yakutat? And he's like, come in for some food. And we're just like, yes. We go into the kitchen, and at first I remember Graham sat down on some of their nice, like, wooden seats that they have inside the lodge. It's an upscale lodge, and Graham's filthy. I'm just like, mud filth, and I think they asked us to move outside, so we moved outside, and they were super apologetic about the kitchen being under renovation, and all they have are tater tots and fish sticks, and we were just plowing through these peanut butter cookies they make. They have these amazing cookies. All of us are just slamming cookies, and so we load up, we go back down to the river, they come down, take some pictures of us, and pats on the back and everything, and we get back in the river, and it was just another day on the river, and then we pulled out and into town in McCarthy.
That must have been nice to roll into town there, huh?
It's amazing. It's amazing. And it's full-on summer there at that point. And I remember Josh, we don't have any other clothes besides what we're wearing, so Josh's mom was walking around in his ski boots, and we heard a tourist say, I guess some people think there's always snow in Alaska. And we're all so underweight and just scrappy and eating everything we can. And it was pretty amazing. I don't expect to ever experience anything like it again, and I don't need to. It's kind of nice having had that high point.
Now my mind is returning, and my eyes, they can't see. Feel the blood in my feet and the smile on your face. Now there's a Y at the junction. It takes a while to get there, don't you know? I never spend much time asking directions. Yes, I was just young.
The Logan trip was a towering experience for Luke, and it cemented all the values he held at the core of his being. Just like his experiences in the classics, the Logan Traverse had pushed Luke to the edge of his physical and mental limits, but it was also a breakthrough in realizing what he was truly capable of. In the ensuing years, Luke continued participating in the classics and even took on the role of event organizer. But during the summer race of 2014, a tragic event with his friend Rob would challenge Luke's perspectives and force him to grapple with a whole new set of life lessons.
Yes, I was just young. I always used to find myself pretending. I guess I was just young.
He was a rugby player, so big dude, huge legs, but not a mountain sport athlete. He wasn't a strong climber. He wasn't a strong boater. He was just strong. He never was part of the competitive nature of any of these summers or winters. He was just doing it for himself, for Rob. And he did a lot. He did, I think, 9 or 10 or more. So he had a lot of experience. And his approach was just to carry a bunch of gear. He had, you know, extra socks and a sleeping bag. And he even had, like, down booties on the summer courses. And nobody's bringing down. No people, you know, most people wouldn't bring down booties even on the winter one to save weight. But one of the beauties about the classics is that you they're yours. You make it to be what you want it to be. And his was just to finish, and that might take 3 days longer than the last guy, or not. More than once, his group finished twice, just because only two groups finished, and he just persevered through. So there was this joke about Rob as being team heavy. He might bring a beer, you know. He might bring a little metal stove that you can put wood in, and the rest of us are, you know, cutting the hand. We're not cutting the handles off of toothbrushes. We're not even bringing toothbrushes. Yeah. So on this course between Thompson Pass and McCarthy, I traveled with him and Greg Mills, that was his partner, for the first couple of days. I had had whooping cough all summer, so I was really out of shape and just wanted to see a route and travel slow, and so I had never been on the same pace with them because I was always cutting all the corners and trying to sprint, and so wasn't committed to traveling with them, but thought it might work out, and the first couple of days it worked out. After a couple of days, we ended up traveling with John Picar. He was on that as well, with another friend, Matt Kuplik. And so all of us traveled together for a while. And then I, maybe just because I was a couple of days into it, I started to feel stronger, and I was ready to push it a little bit. And Matt and John were going a faster pace. And so I stuck with Matt and John, and we split from Greg and Rob. And that's really normal in the classics as well. Things are pretty dynamic. People that travel on their own often end up partnering with somebody, and then whatever happens. So we finished the course. There was a water crux, and going into this course, it was part of the content I made available to people. I think if anything goes wrong, it's gonna be on the water, because there's a lot of nasty water at multiple. You know, we had to cross the Copper River, which is the most benign of all the rivers on this course. So that gives you a sense, like, that's a lot of water. And it ends on the Tana, which has a canyon section that's class 4, big water class 4, which is a serious whitewater features. One group had flown in ahead of time to run it with, you know, full safety and kind of see what it's like. Some other guys were some hotshot whitewater boaters in Anchorage, and so they assumed they'd be running it, and Rob and Greg knew they weren't going to run it. Rob was afraid of water. His wife Tammy has a great story about them being on the beach in Hawaii, and there's a bunch of little kids and Rob wearing life vests like on the sand. He just hated water, but he had a lot of experience in it because of these classics. He'd been on the Talkeetna, which is another big water. So they walked around all of the technical features in the Tana Canyon. And then, this is all secondhand from Greg, put in after the features, and just because it is big water with weird hydraulics, you know, there's swells and boils, and some of that caught Rob and he tipped, and Greg was able to get his boat, but didn't see Rob again, and hoped that Rob was on the bank, and he just, you know, wasn't sure if he was upstream or downstream, but maybe he's on the other bank. And so Greg went down with both boats to a first place he could get out on the river, and built a huge fire so that the smoke would be there, so that Rob would figure out where he was. But he called to, you know, waited a little while because that kind of stuff happens in the classics. A lot of people swim and then get back in your boat. Maybe it takes a while to find your boat, whatever. I don't know if Greg knew right away or not how serious that was, but he probably knew right away that this was a big deal. Rob was wearing rain gear and a life vest, but he's a big dude, big rugby player, and he probably had a bunch of equipment on him. You know, maybe we often would carry a stove in our pocket or something in our sat phone or in reach in case you get separated from your boat. So he might have had some gear with him. But Greg called. This was in the afternoon, and it got dark, and first light in the morning. a pilot from Ultima Thule, who was a friend, flew and looked, but he was also a heli pilot for the PJs, and so he said, call RCC and just get the ball rolling, which was a huge help for me because I hadn't coordinated something like that. So I had finished with John and Matt and then booked right back to Anchorage. As soon as I got to Anchorage, I had these messages from Greg and then jumped on what to do.
You see, you had no idea when you finished the race and you had head back to Anchorage.
Yeah.
I mean, when you heard the news, what happened?
Initially, you know, you hear that Greg is separated from Rob and Rob doesn't have any of his gear. And I'm still not very alarmed because Rob has a ton of experience and it happens. You're in Alaska on a big river or in the woods, you know, I get separated from my partners all the time and have stopped and built a fire just to wait, you know, Josh Mum gets too far in front of me and I can't figure out where he went and I backtrack and build a fire and wait for him to come back. So I wasn't worried about it. I hadn't seen the Tana. When we were to the Tana, we cut overland, this like miserable bushwhack, to just miss it completely, and it took a lot of time, but one of our guys hadn't done any pack rafting before, so it was a no-brainer. We didn't even consider it. So I wasn't very concerned at first, and I was resistant to flying or to contacting RCC initially, and then it was overnight. His wife, Tammy, we were talking a lot, and she really needed to know. You know, she was really worried, understandably. So I called Ultima Thule and talked to Grandma. She's up in the morning to make breakfast, and she said, oh, Ben, our pilot, he'll be up at 8. I'll call again then. I said, okay, and then talked to Tammy again, and she's like, we need to move on this now. So I called back and said, sorry, Grandma, I hate to inconvenience you, but we need to move. This might be a big deal. So she got Ben, and really his guidance was just huge for me, not having gone through this experience before. And he flew first light and didn't see anything, but given what I told him, which was basically that Rob was in rain gear, swam, and Greg didn't see him again, like, he's like, you know, let's get the ball rolling. But after Ben's flight, where Ben wasn't able to see him, I think that was, things were starting to anticipate the worst case scenario there. And then RCC could talk directly to Greg, and that they preferred, you know, they don't need to go through me. So I was cut out of the loop at that point. And then didn't hear until they found Rob's body. And that was completely devastating. I think partly because I hadn't lost any friends before. Rob and I weren't, like, we didn't hang out outside of the classics, but we saw each other twice a year for each classic. We were the two that were most reliably there, and we had this great kind of teasing connection where he'd tease me about leaving one crampon behind to save weight, and I'd tease him about carrying three crampons just in case one breaks, you know, and a lot of respect for each other with our different styles, and you try to feed him a compliment, you just turn it right around on you, so all of a sudden you realize you're talking about you instead, and, you know, just a pretty amazing person. And that hit me really hard, and still I think it's, you know, still nearly daily that I'm thinking about him, which is maybe surprising in that we weren't that close. But then I think the connection we had was a connection that was kind of primal or something about how much those classics meant to us. It was part of his wedding vow that he would continue doing these classics. And yeah, super intense. I've never been knocked like that by a loss, and have lost some friends since, and they haven't affected me as strongly, and I think part of that is just because of the shock of the initial, the reality of that, you know. We'd all been taking risks for a long time, but nobody had been caught.
How did you process that at the time?
I spent a lot of time thinking about how different it would have been if I'd stayed with Greg and Rob. And I know that's ridiculous, but I can't just rationalize my way out of considering it as an option. And I'm really confident that I would have been able to help on the water, either by being right there with Rob or figuring out a way to walk around that section, put in further down or whatever. So a big part of it was replaying and regret and responsibility and blame. And I know with all of those things that I'm not to blame, I'm not responsible, but of course I can still replay what would have happened. And then thinking about what we're supposed to learn from that. And I put a lot of thought into that, and also wanting to kind of preserve these stories about Rob's style and collecting stories to share. And that was all a big part of that. For each of the losses that I've had now, that's a big part of how I process, is trying to come up with something tangible to get out of it, you know, the positive. And one thing that's come out of that for me has been teaching swiftwater courses, and that's very directly related to wanting to help people avoid whatever mistakes he made. I think if I could have done that with him before, it might have made all the difference. I truly believe that. Just being able to fall in the water and not freak out. I'm sure he freaked out because he hated water. And, you know, you take a big inhale like that, and then your lungs are collapsed, and then it gets really hard, especially if you're in glacial water. So that was a long answer about processing, and it's been a long process of processing. What do we take from this that's positive? And with Rob, there has been a lot, and there's been a lot of times when I've been considering options, and I think, what would Rob do?
It seems like he made a pretty big impact on you.
Yeah, huge. I think what was rewarding in the classics for me was the same to him, even more so than, like, I mean, I think we had that in common more than even John and I, like my partner. It's like something about what the classics did for Rob and what the classics did for me was a huge bond for us.
Luke continues to make his home in Alaska and is still active in the Wilderness Classics, as well as his own personal journeys. Just this spring, Luke and his longtime partner Josh Mumm completed a 200-mile traverse of Katmai National Park and Preserve, summiting and skiing a few glacier-capped volcanoes along the way. I guess those tourists in McCarthy didn't realize there is always snow in Alaska. But climbing and skiing aren't the only important activities in Luke's life these days. In 2016, he started a Stickers for Conservation campaign, which has raised over $20,000 for environmental conservation groups. You can find out more about this and Luke's other adventures at his website, thingstolookat.com. Before I ended my conversation with Luke, I asked him to reflect on his time in Alaska's wilderness and what some of his future goals might be.
I think that, yeah, if I had to identify one part in this that is sort of the lesson or what I've been amazed to discover, is just how capable we are of persisting or of surviving. Like, just the realization that I don't need a sleeping bag, and realize, like, yeah, there's ways for me to stay warm. So I think we all probably have a lot of defined limitations that are just defined on what's normal or what's understood to be normal for whatever, outdoor sports, life, relationships, whatever. and in the process of going through these classics, having a little bit of a safety net, and then applying it to bigger mountains, longer trips, like what's come out of that is sort of an awe at how capable I am just by being human, being able to problem solve and having this natural, I don't know, gift for survival. You know, like our bodies don't want to put themselves at risk and don't want to run so long that they don't function. So even if I'm uncomfortable, my body will let me sleep, even if it's on a huge rock right under my back. You know, like, it's hard to convey, even though I'm thinking of it as such a simple realization, but it's just like the power of being human, I guess. And I wouldn't have made that realization if I hadn't had gradually progressed through all these trips and built up to Logan and then tapered off since Logan, you know, and been able to put in a comfort, like a buffer on the trip since then, where it's like, well, I don't need to carry 30 days food, but you know what, if I run out of food, I'm probably going to be okay. I'll probably figure out a way to get through that. So that could bite me in the ass at some point, and people die in the mountains. There's inherent risk. Even if you're making all the right decisions, there's that risk. But there's also a huge skill set, just by being human. And I think we all have it, and it isn't necessarily tapped into. So that's been really powerful for me.
Where do you see the trajectory of like your mountain exploration and adventure going? What are some things that you would like to do?
Well, I'm definitely slowing down physically. I'm aware of that. And I anticipate having knee issues and physical limitations before I'm that much older. I have, like, I can't flex my right foot. I've had surgery a few times, and so I've got stuff that makes staying active difficult, and it'll continue getting more difficult. So I am not sure how devastating that's going to be. I'm kind of hoping that I'll just sort of evolve out of needing it so badly at the same time that I evolve out of being able to do it. And that's probably realistic, you know. My friends that are starting families, they're evolving into that kind of adventure, and that's super rewarding for them. And so I know I'll be in Alaska. I know Alaska will be a huge priority for me, and I want to be as active as possible, but I'm also expecting to not be as active, and I want to see so much more of the state. I get overwhelmed. I get stressed out when I'm looking at maps, and it's like, I still haven't been on the Seward Peninsula. I've seen 1/3 of the Brooks Range. I haven't seen the Eastern Alaska Range. I've got all these things I'd still like to see, and I'd like to see them in the same style that I'm able to see them now, but we'll see what happens.
Thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you got as much out of Luke's stories as I did, and I hope you can apply some of his outdoor wisdom to your next trip in the mountains. I had music production assistance from my good friend James Glaives today. You can check more of his stuff out at jamesglaives.com. Don't forget to review the podcast on iTunes, and don't forget to join the email list at thefernline.com. And finally, if you enjoy the tunes you hear, you can check out more of my music on iTunes, Spotify, Bandcamp, and evanphillips.net. Until next time, I'm Evan Phillips, and this is The Fern Line.